Hello, this is Paul Sandel, Assistant Professor of History at Stephen F. Austin State University and Director of the Charlie Wilson Oral History Project. We are in Washington, D.C. at the Russell Senate Building in Senator Hutchinson's conference room. And I am in the room with Scott Sosby, Professor at SFA, and Laura Blackburn, a graduate student. And today, we are here interviewing Candace Hooper. Candace, welcome.
Thank you.
I first was hoping to maybe get a little background information about you and then maybe share a little bit about yourself and maybe take us up to the point of when you first met Charlie.
Okay. I come from a military family, a Navy family. I was born on Guam. My father was retired as a Master Chief Hospital Corpsman, but he was a Navy Hospital Corpsman through most of his military career. Moved a lot of places, finally ended up at the University of Illinois, where I took a degree in journalism. My last semester there, or actually before my last semester, one of my professors suggested that I apply for something called the Sears Journalism Internship. At that time, Sears Roebuck would bring 30 journalism students, either juniors or seniors, to Washington and place them in congressional offices. Sears interns were eagerly sought above all other interns because they, theoretically at least, we knew how to write. And so that was the one thing that they needed. And so I actually got chosen as an intern, and when they went to place me with somebody, I don't know how they did it. They said they did it based on common interests or something. But I ended up in the office of Congressman Jake Pickle. And we figured out later, he and I, that the only reason I ended up there was because he had an unusual name. And my maiden name is Shy, so I was Candy Shy and he was Jake Pickle. And so we think that was probably it. So that was my last semester of college. That would have been the spring of 1973, and I came out here. At that time, the Texas delegation, I believe, had only two Republican members. It was all Democratic. The two Republican members, and there might have been three, but the two I remember were Alan Steelman and Bill Archer. So, but when people spoke about the Texas delegation, or when the Democrats, they talked about the delegation, it was just the Democrats. Every Wednesday, the Texas delegation had lunch in the Rayburn Room of the Capitol, which is right across from the members' dining room. And every other Wednesday, the members were encouraged to bring a guest or constituent or somebody as, you know, a guest to the luncheon. And so on one of those alternate Wednesdays, Mr. Pickle decided that I should be the guest. At that time, his administrative assistant was a man named Tony Proffitt, who was later pretty famous in Texas political circles, as you all well know. And Mr. Pickle, they were on the floor doing some business, so Tony walked me over, and as it happened, Charlie Wilson had just come in and sat down, and so Tony placed me next to Charlie and said, "Charlie, you take care of her." And that was, you know, at that point, speaking sort of objectively, that was really fine with Charlie. You know, I was much better looking. I was younger. I had long blonde hair. You know, I was named Candy Shy, which is, you know, going to get his attention anyway. Well, right. And so we just sort of met each other at that lunch. This is a long story, but shortening it up, I think that was probably in March, and then in late April, I was to go back to the University of Illinois for my graduation, and literally the day that I was leaving, I had taken a job with Congressman Bob Steele of Connecticut. He had advertised for a press secretary. I had decided to take that job at the munificent annual salary of $8,000, which I thought was amazing. But I was still in Mr. Pickle's office my last day. There was a call for a vote as Mr. Pickle walked across the street to vote here at the Capitol. He ran into Charlie. He mentioned, "Oh, do you remember Candy Shy? Mm-hmm. She just took a job with Bob Steele." Charlie went back to his office, called down and talked to me and said, you know, come up and talk to me. I want you to work for me. If you wanted a job, you should have called me. So I went up. I talked to him. He offered me $9,000, which was unbelievable. I decided also, well, I already knew everything that you'd need to know about Texas because I'd worked for Mr. Pickle for 3 months. And so it was going to be an easier transition. And I then went down to Bob Steele's office and said, I'm very sorry, but I've taken a better offer. So, and then the next day I was back to Illinois for my graduation and didn't come back until about July 23rd of that year to start as Charlie's assistant press assistant. That's what I was hired at. At that point, Charlie did not have a press assistant, but he knew that I wasn't really qualified to be the press assistant for the most junior member of the Texas delegation. I think he was thinking of, you know, Johnny Apple or William Sapphire or somebody like that to be his press assistant. Because he'd had a man there as a press assistant who had left, who was a local radio commentator. But by the time I arrived, I was really assistant to nobody, but he had actually hired, in the interim, Al Reinert, and I don't know, you know him. Great, great writer, total character, complete iconoclast. And Al finally did show up, but by the time he showed up, he had been trying to patch together, really start his writing career. And he had 100 proposals out to 100 magazines for articles to try to, and nobody had said yes to him or anything. And so he had accepted this job from Charlie, but by the time he got here, he had lots of interest because, I can't remember, it was either Playboy or Penthouse or one of those that had published his article about the madam in the whorehouse in Texas. That later Larry King took Larry that King story did, and made the best little story.
It was Playboy.
Yeah. And when that hit, then everybody wanted Al Reinert to write, and so he was generally too busy to deal with Charlie's stuff. Charlie at that time, well, I can stop there and let you ask questions. But Charlie at that time, was his office was on the second floor of the Longworth building,
okay.
Room 1214. But often people had annexes, and his annex was two floors up, I think like 1416. It was a small little room, and it was just going to be Al and me. And Al lived in a basement apartment on New Jersey Avenue, not far across from where Charlie lived. And if nobody's told you about the apartment that Charlie had when he first came, the one that was designed for Gene McCarthy, you should get that story. But what would happen would be that Charlie would call up to the annex, say, you know, I need Al down here. We're going to do something. Al would not be there. It might be 11 o'clock. It might be 1 in the afternoon. He never had his phone on in the apartment and, of course, no cell phone. So then I would race down the stairs, run the two blocks, wake him up, and get him into Charlie's office. I would always say, oh, he's on the phone with the Dallas Morning News or the Houston Chronicle, or, you know, he'll get right back to you. But so it was great fun. And then finally, Al, I think, got pulled into the real sustainable infrastructure of Texas Monthly, which was a startup back then, and went back to Texas. Yeah. And
you
then
worked for them for a number of years.
Yeah.
And then you took over as...
Yeah. I mean, there was this gap where I think Charlie was still hoping to find somebody much more qualified. And it would have been great to have worked with somebody else who was a great writer, but in the meantime, the press releases were being churned out, the radio shows were being done, you know, and finally he says, okay, you know. But from that point on, and Charlie really was the best boss I ever had, because he really focused on what you did, and you know, and it was a real meritocracy in that office.
Well, can you describe a little bit of his management style as a boss?
As a boss. He had certain things that he was extremely rigid about. and you probably have heard some of this already. Some of it stemmed from this incident that he always talked about when his mother came to Washington at some point and went to, I believe it was Senator Yarbrough's office, and stood in the anteroom as the people in the anteroom talked to each other and talked on the phone and didn't greet his mother properly. Just sort of like, you know, walked in, nobody's paying attention.
Yeah.
Wilma did not put up with that sort of thing and came back and told that story to Charlie. And so the focus on the greeting, the focus on the appearance of the office, the focus on the tone of that front room, and I think that's in part why when he moved to the, he was much more comfortable too when he moved to the Rayburn building, because you had a smaller front office, much more easily controlled than in Longworth. You know, there were probably five or six desks in that main room, and no partitions at the time or anything. The offices look very different now. But so that there was a setting that was that he was very particular about for constituents, for people to come in, to be really, the focus was on them. And that was an important part of it. As both an adjunct to that, and I think as part of his own nature, came all of the emphasis on appearance. Now, of course, Charlie liked to have good-looking women around him, and I often really make the point that I was one of the back office people. The front office girls were really gorgeous. That and there, he was very particular about your appearances. I mean, you know, you had to look nice, you had to dress nice, but it was really part of the ambiance that he wanted the visitor to see and feel and, you know, understand. That would seem superficial, but not in a sense of constituent service.
Well, that's what I was talking about. Does that fall into his extreme detail to constituent service,
yeah.
Which, and I'm sure you can add to much about how he felt about constituents and what was important.
Yeah. Well, of course, if you've talked with Peggy, then you get that.
Mm-hmm.
But in the back office, too, I mean, the woman that sat next to me for most of the time was the woman who did the VA Social Security stuff. You know, it was just stunning, you know, the problems that she dealt with and how rigorously, you know, every inquiry that came in had to have an answer, or at least an answer that work was in progress, within 24 hours. The person had to know that something was being done about their problem. And that was, you know, there was no shirking on that. There were no excuses allowed about that. I think so much of it was detail. And what it all fed into was this notion that you had this, you know, really good looking, really warm greeting, you know, atmosphere. And it fed into one of Charlie's greatest strengths as a legislator, which was that he was very willing to be, even he strategically encouraged people to underestimate him.
Is that okay? Can you expound on that some? Because we ask that question to people and they seem a little reluctant to give us the answer. I think they know that that's the case.
Oh, no. I think it's absolutely true. I don't think there's any other way to explain. There are other ways. He had great strengths in terms of his personality, his character, and his negotiating abilities. But his greatest secret weapon was the fact that his eye was always on the prize, and if it would help that people underestimated him, then that was not a problem. And you could see that in many, many you know, I sort of saw that in a lot of different contexts. The fight that he went through to get on the Appropriations Committee, because he had to fight the entire Texas delegation to get on the Appropriations, and he had to go around them and put his name forward, get his name put forward in the Speaker's Committee, the Democratic, what did they call that, committee that chose people for that chose who was going to be on committees when that when the quote Texas Appropriations Chair came up, and he was fighting Richard White. The delegation had always chosen on the basis of seniority, and at that point, you know, that delegation was probably the strongest delegation that ever existed, because everybody was either chairman of a major committee or chairman of a major subcommittee, except when you got down really to, like, Charlie. I mean, you got down to the junior people. And part of that, you could go back and look at when they forced Jake Pickle to go on to Ways and Means. He didn't want to go on to Ways and Means. He was really happy at Interstate Commerce and Science and Technology. And they said, no, because if you don't go, the next senior member is Bob Eckhart. They did not want Bob Eckhart on Ways and Means. And so they forced Jake Pickle to take Ways and Means. Okay. So that was how rigid. That was how controlling the delegation was. But Charlie was willing to stand up to him and say, you know, we can't have Richard White on appropriations. That can't be our guy
that
on appropriations.
Quite the plucky move on his part.
Oh my! Oh, it did. I mean, he was ostracized by most of the delegation. I think really, except Mr. Pickle, who, of course, was smart enough to see that you didn't want to piss off the newest Texas member of the Appropriations Committee. But, yeah, no, it was, I mean, there was this sort of radio silence from the whole delegation. He was persona non grata at the delegation lunches for quite a while.
And I knew that he, for example, he and George Mahon had basically got where they didn't speak to each other anymore. But I didn't know the genesis of it after hearing.
But it wasn't just Mahon. I mean, it was you know, that was something that it was more institutional than personal. They just felt that Charlie had you know, screwed with the delegation, and that he wasn't supposed to do that. And they also, I think, really felt that he wasn't worthy of it yet. I mean, he was too much the playboy image, too much this or that. But by that time, he had already taken on most of the delegation, too, in his fight on the depletion allowance. And that was his first big legislative effort and legislative...
For our purposes, can you explain that more?
Sure.
That is big legislation.
It was really huge at the time, and in fact, it was so huge that later Charlie said, you know, Candy, if we'd known what we were taking on, we never would have done it. But as we were sort of hurtling toward the oil embargo, the disparity in the prices of natural gas in Texas versus nationally became huge. There were gas lines in Texas long before there were any gas lines in the rest of the country and all. And that was because it was sort of this little island controlled by, where the prices were controlled by the Texas Railroad Commission. And so they had a whole separate pricing structure then for the rest of the country. And so it became, all of the shortages began showing up in Texas early. So responding to some of those variations and beginning to see the concern that could spread elsewhere, Congressman named Bill Green from Philadelphia, I think, proposed to eliminate the percentage depletion. The focus there was on the major oil companies, the Seven Sisters. There were still seven of them back then. And the arguments were, you know, they're making huge amounts of money, and they've got this enormous tax loophole, that's not rooted in reality, and so let's get rid of it. And what happened as a result of that, because they could see steam building up on that, and you know, the tensions against the oil companies were rising very rapidly. So a group of Texas independent oil producers and a couple from Kansas began to think about the possibility of ditching the majors and just going for a save for themselves. Okay, let's try to distinguish between the major oil companies let's distinguish between the independent oil producers who were the guys that were going out and finding the oil, and then a lot of their properties would be sold to the majors, and the majors who were not really finding new sources of oil but were then finding and, you know, producing and refining it and selling it. This had never been contemplated within the oil industry. Everybody was supposed to be, you know, locked in arms together. But they could see that they were going to lose the depletion allowance, and they knew they had a good story to tell. So they started, and apparently I think within the course of 1 or 2 days, and they had some representation here in town, including Harry McPherson, who recently died, was the representative for the Kansas oil producers. He came to them, or they came to him and hired him, and then the Texas producers hired a man named Dick Klein, who was actually from California but was here and was a liberal Democrat. So they were savvy enough to know they hired these two Democrats, a Texas Democrat, you know, and they made the rounds, and they started with the most senior person in the Texas delegation, I think would have still been George Mahon at that time. And they had appointments set up in descending order of seniority. And the answer, the question was, will you help us save the percentage depletion allowance for independents? When Bill Green's bill comes to the floor, will you add an amendment that excludes the independent producers from the removal of the depletion allowance? No, 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 no. They get to Charlie. And I remember, because I was in that meeting, this was when he started the practice of, okay, this is a subject that I'm not on any committee on. At that point, he was still on Veterans Affairs and Post Office and Civil Service. And so who do I ask to come and sort of sit through on the legislative side? And so this is the press secretary. And so that's why you see, even in the movie, the press secretary, which was not me at that time, but has such a dominant role, because whenever something came up that he didn't feel either fell neatly into a category or that he felt needed some additional attention within the office and not just from later the appropriations staff person, who was always, you know, I mean, they were rocket scientists. He would go to the press secretary. So anyway, we went in the meeting, and they said, here's what we want to do. Fair notice. Everybody else in the delegation has said no, and in fact said they would oppose it. They did not, I don't think they went to Bob Eckhart, though, because I think they felt that he was a non-starter as a proponent of this legislation. His politics and, you know, also his sort of personal style was not aggressive enough, I think they felt. But I think they felt that he was just not a good choice. So, again, they get to Charlie, and Charlie says, you know, here, help. I've been fighting big companies all my life. If the majors don't like this, that's too bad. You know, he talked to them about his fight on the telephone, against the telephone company down in Texas. And so he took it on. He said, yes, he'd do it. And then that just started this huge, colossal fight.
And that is all an interesting concept. I'm from West Texas, and so we think independent producers should get everything in the majors. We should get rid of them anyway. But it is interesting that the whole delegation, I mean, because later, the retention oil depletion, and particularly the independent producers, becomes a big issue in Texas.
Oh yeah,
you know, but that becomes a big issue. But the whole delegation would.
But at the point in time, at this point in time, where you had to stand down the major oil companies, they were not prepared to do that. And it's understandable at that point in time because of the whole sort of economic and political and everything history of Texas. Why would you necessarily easily stand up and say to the major oil companies, no, you're toast, and no, I, you know, I'm not going to just go into the joust with, you know, with the lance and fight for you, you know, to the bitter end. I'm not even sure that it wasn't that they didn't see that the end was there. Maybe some of them did, but I think that they had this sense of loyalty. Well, Charlie had never, you know, he had no experience of the major oil companies being loyal to him. And in fact, he had had very little experience with the independent producers. I mean, he knew the difference, which most people in Congress didn't know. And then that was really the launching. And to go back to this whole point of people underestimating Charlie and him using that, he did this masterful job of deploying these independent oil producers on their own to tell their stories. And the way that he ran this operation was both a sort of like a model of military efficiency and Machiavellian strategy, because he would call up members of Congress, and at that time, I mean, already he knew so many of them. I mean, that's just his chemistry. He just, he got to know people. But even members he didn't know, he'd call up and he'd say, you know, did you know that there are guys, there are these little oil folks that are fighting the major oil companies every day, and, you know, would you let one of them come and talk to you? Well, it's hard to say no to a colleague. And then, so he'd set up a whole range of meetings, and they would bring in more of their people. And every morning, probably for, I don't know, not straight, but at least a month, 7:30 in the morning, they were to show up in his office, and Charlie would be there. Now, who would think Charlie would be even in his office at 7:30? He would be there. He would first do an inspection, and he would make them take off their gold cufflinks, their gold tie bars. He would, you know, just literally, and then he would talk to them about how to talk to Yankees. Okay. And not telling them to change anything, but, you know, just how to be succinct, how to get to the points that he felt needed to be made, their points, their story, but how to tell their story. And he would get to know each one of them, and if they had a special story, you know, that would be great. And so all the cufflinks would go into his safe in his office, and we'd run downstairs to the House door when they came up and get little congressional cufflinks for them all. And then they would go out on these meetings. And then at the end of the day, so this would be like maybe 6 o'clock or so, they all had to come back in and they had to tell them, you know, who did they see, what did they say. And Charlie would look at that for what kind of follow-up needed to be done. One day, one of the oil men came in, one of the Ernie Cockrell, and I don't know if you know him, but Cockrell Petroleum. Now, he was very young then. He came in. He had his arm in a sling, and when he walked in the door, Charlie said, "That's great."
It's like, yeah, get everybody a sling.
Yeah. And then he said, "How did that happen?" And he said, "Well, I broke it skiing in Vail." He said, "Oh, don't tell him that. He fell down the stairs or something. You know, nothing like that." But it's just the sort of seizing on, you know, let's have somebody that you can get some sympathy with right away. And so we did that. I mean, he did that. It was almost an exhaustive schedule. And he was sort of sitting there behind the scenes, and then he would be calling and following up. But then beyond that, he could see that the one person that he needed, the one person they needed to support this amendment, was the person that they had bypassed, and that was Bob Eckert. He knew that if his amendment went to the floor and Bob Eckhart didn't support it, it would lose a lot of Democratic votes because Bob was such a liberal, but he was a Texan. He would have been the one that would have been expected to support this. So he told them, he said, we've got to give this amendment to Bob, and we've got to get him on board. Well, it was a 3-page amendment, and Eckhart was just known for his wordsmithing, for his tireless noodling with language. And so they gave it, Charlie gave it to Eckhart and said, you know, look this over, make whatever changes you need to be comfortable with it. Because Eckhart was comfortable with the idea, but he wanted it to be ironclad tight. It was a 3-page amendment. When it got to him, it came back as an 11-page amendment.
Wow.
And so that, you know, that's going to complicate things on the floor, because the more words there are, the more people are going to think that there are actually loopholes rather than
closing.
And so it became a point of, you know, legislative importance that Eckhart had crafted this amendment to make sure that, you know, the majors weren't going to get a benefit, backdoor benefit from it, and that it was, you know, going to do what it would do. And then when Bill Green's amendment went to the floor, this was Charlie's first time to really offer an amendment on the floor, and he did something that, at least as far as we were told then, and I don't know because I've not looked back in the history, but that nobody had ever done before. He had had these big charts prepared without thinking. You know, I mean, you need some visual aids, okay? Well, they said, you know, at least the sergeant at arms there or whatever at the time said, no, you can't do this. And he said, I can't do this. He said, why not? Well, then they couldn't find any reason he couldn't do it. But nobody, they never had that before. So Charlie had these big charts on the floor. It was huge. It was really amazing, because then they would see. Nowadays they do it all the time.
Yeah.
But at least at that time, at least what we were told, that hadn't been done, you know, in the history of that particular Congress. So he fought. We lost that amendment, I'm going to say, on the floor of the House by about 17 votes. Every Republican voted against it. Not just Texas Republicans, but all the Republicans voted against it. And a few Democrats, and we lost it. So then he went over to the Senate side and sat down with Senator Benson, and then Benson and Long introduced it, and they passed it on the Senate floor.
Mm-hmm. Which is, yeah, see, I didn't know. I knew the Benson-Long passing of that. Like, I didn't know Charlie's.
Oh, no, I think it would be really interesting to even go back and look at read the congressional record for that time, because I was sitting up in the gallery at that time, and, you know, it was just fascinating. But the point was that when he took the floor, I mean, I think the other members, they knew that he was going to offer the amendment, but they had no idea how well he had, you know, the kind of campaign he had mounted to support this. Because by the time it got to the floor, all of the leading Democrats really supported it. And it was the conservative Democrats and the Republicans that defeated it.
Now, when you say this is then a part of an example of he's being extremely successful, or it results in a success, but you're saying he strategically set about to play on people underestimating him.
Right.
And is this an example where he would sort of, not play dumb, but let them underestimate how sharp I really am, and then go for the kill?
Right. I think that was a good example, because he sort of worked behind the scenes, and then it really was a tremendous victory, even though it was a defeat. Nobody could imagine you could come that close at that time. But Charlie didn't go crowing about it. He just said, okay, now let's work on the next thing. Let's go get it done. Let's go over to the Senate. In terms of being underestimated, I think it was more the fact that he he put together these campaigns, the campaign to get on the Appropriations Committee. Mm-hmm. I mean, he lobbied very quietly. We did a poll of how many people in Congress at that time, and I don't even remember what year this was, but I mean, Charlie was a relatively new member. Richard White had been there for 20 years or more. We did a poll of how many members of Congress knew Richard White, and there were some members that didn't even know there was a member named Richard White. It was stunning how few members said, yes, I know him, or I've had a conversation with him. Charlie fed that into the mix because not just the delegation, he didn't feed it to the delegation necessarily, but to the steering committee. That's what it was, okay, steering committee. You know, you want the Appropriations Committee, they want it to be a strong committee. They want the Democrats on that committee to be strong and be able to get things done. And then to see that here was this member had been here 20 years and a lot of people didn't even know he was there. What kind of a, you know, advocate would that be? But it was not a campaign that broke out into the open, you know, that made the press. I don't think even in Texas. It was just, he kept it very quiet. Even when the vote was taken, I gave him a little cup that was inscribed after the vote because he stood outside, and every member that came out of that steering committee, I think there were 25 members, said they voted for him, and the vote was 13 to 12. So
Same thing in academia.
but you know, all of a sudden people woke up and Charlie was on the Appropriations Committee. And it's like, whoa, you know, how did this happen? Mm-hmm. And then they thought, well, you know, what's he going to do on the Appropriations Committee? I mean, some of them may have thought it was a worse choice than Richard White because, you know, this was a guy that, I mean, he used to stand at the cafeteria at Longworth. I remember one time, Ron Dellums was one of his great friends. And when one day they were standing there, you know, sort of back to back, measuring whether who was taller and whether Dellums could use his afro as part of his height. You know, it just everybody's there watching him, you know, goof around. Mm-hmm. So,
do you think that that's part of? Do you think he intentionally cultivated then the Good Time Charlie image for that particular purpose?
I think that he realized how effective it could be. And I, you know, I've never looked at it closely, but I imagine that was part of that was a secret of his success in the Texas legislature, too. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly you have to look at the notion of moving ahead to the time when I was not in the office and the whole Afghanistan operation.
When did you leave the office, by the way?
I left in 78.
78.
In July of 78. You have to look at that and say anybody else who had done that would have been out touting it, you know, all the time.
Sure.
He never did. I mean, I don't think until George Crile's book came out that even all of us on his staff, maybe with the exception of, you know, maybe Peyton, maybe Elaine, really knew all the pieces in there. Charlie was the only one. And as close as he was to lots of his friends, as often as he talked about bits and pieces, I mean, I didn't bring, you know, he would bring war rugs back, he would bring, you know, Pakistani chests back, he would bring back things and tell these tales. I don't think any of us, I know we did not, really appreciate all of the pieces because he didn't talk about them. Like, I think a lot of
that is actually amazing.
Done that,
I mean, nobody knew.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And why would you know? You would know if the member of Congress who had done that talked about it. And I think the tendency would be to think that most people would, you know, if they had basically brought down the Soviet Union, wouldn't you think you'd had a party or two to celebrate it and a book deal or something like that?
Yeah.
No. Since you had worked with Pickle. Mm-hmm. And Charlie. And they were friends. They were good friends. But kind of compare them as congressmen, style, and how they were and how they fought. Do you think Charlie modeled himself on Pickle's son?
No, I think Charlie was sui generis. Is that the word? I think he was, himself incarnate. I think, certainly he had heroes, and in his office were, Lincoln, FDR, the George Washington print. I think he had strong heroes and, a sense of a not only a public duty but a sense of public leadership, but I think he probably, if I would think about it more, shamelessly borrowed any good idea that he ever saw, but he made up things that were just astonishing. You've seen and heard of Dear Colleague letters. They're a letter, and then you have, mostly the deal is you have pages and pages of signatures, but the letter is first, and it goes into detail about what kind of legislation is going to be. Charlie is the first person I ever saw who sent out a Dear Colleague letter, and everybody thought it was a mistake, but it was not, where the signature page was the first page, because he had these extreme liberals and these extreme conservatives. It was one that we followed later, and I'm trying to remember. He probably did that first in the percentage depletion, where, he would get a couple of conservatives, but I know that in our lobbying firm days, when Charlie was a lobbying partner of ours, we used that. And it was absolutely modeled on something I remembered from Charlie's office, and Charlie did too. We used that on a letter that we encouraged to be put together about the sale of IMF gold, where we had Jesse Helms and Jesse Jackson Jr., their signatures. That was the first page of the letter. And so, you were going to read that letter.
Was it his force of personality that allowed him to bridge extreme liberals and extreme conservatives, for example? Or did he really fall in the middle of those two groups?
Well, I think, generally, he probably did. But his force of personality, I think, made it easier for him to, attract them. And the thing that the one line that I remember when Dick Klein, who was the lobbyist for the Texas Independence, died, there was a line that actually Harry McPherson, who spoke at his service, said, was that Dick had this ability to make his agenda your agenda. And Charlie, when he said that, I was thinking, well, that was Charlie too. Because Charlie would always find a way, whatever he wanted, he would find a way to make sure that there was something in it for you too, you also. The particular instance was, I think, when he wanted to get more tanks for Israel. And which the there's a big Northeastern contingent that was very intent on Israel, but what Charlie also really wanted was to get more tanks for the United States Army. And so, here he's working, and they're not so crazy about, so he packages the two. Okay, you get your tanks, we get our tanks, let's do this deal. That was the kind of thing, and that begins to sound more like just sort of a trade-off, but it really wasn't. It was more a strategic thinking, And so, I was trying to figure out, again, going back to Alan Steelman and the channelization of the Sabine River, would that have been a big issue? Or maybe it wasn't the Sabine River, but there was a part of a river near Dallas, and the issue was
the
Trinity River, right? And the issue was, whether you're going to channelize it. And so this whole, again, the same Northeastern contingent, is they're all environmentalists, Steelman thought he had him locked up. He never, he was anti the channelization. Charlie was pro the business interest. Steelman didn't work it. Charlie didn't obviously work it. He went back around to all of his friends whom he had dealt with on issues of Israeli national security and worked it. And when that vote took place, I mean, Steelman, he just looked like he'd been hit on the head when he saw all those lights going up, you know, on the voting that went against him from the members that he really thought that he had.
That is it. Yeah. So what do you, I know Laura's itching to ask this question, I should ask her. Let her ask it, because she's interested in the political philosophy. So.
How would you describe Charlie's political philosophy?
Well, you know, that's really hard, because I didn't have much of a political background here, so I didn't. Mostly what I learned was from Charlie. My favorite line from Charlie was when he got here, his closest friends right away were Barbara Jordan, Mickey Leland. And then later, when Bob Carr came into Congress, this young liberal congressman from Michigan who had subscribed to the Texas Observer for years, you know, was dying to meet Charlie, who had been sort of, you know, this iconoclast. But Charlie came to Washington labeled as a Texas liberal, and what he said was, he said, I thought I was a liberal until I came to Washington and met some real ones. But the difference was that in the Texas legislature you're not dealing with national security issues. Mm-hmm. And that's where he was a hawk. So you get this sort of, I don't know, populist split, but you know, on domestic concerns, he was very, he would be put in the moderate to liberal camp. On foreign policy, national security, he was very much a conservative. Now, I have to back up. You all know this story better than I do, and actually most of it took place really before I got there. But you know, his first big legislative victory was the Big Thicket. Mm-hmm. Now, and that was astonishing, you know, as far as I know. So, I mean, that's how I always viewed him, was liberal, domestic, more conservative on national, international issues.
Now, as working as assistant press assistant and then press assistant, what was it, can you take us a little bit, share a little bit about your job, particularly also dealing with Good Time Charlie and sort of dealing with that as someone mm-hmm. in charge of the press?
Well, on the one hand, you know, being Charlie's press assistant was really easy, because all you needed to do, the call would come in from the office and it would come to you from the press. But first of all, with most of the major Texas journalists, and you know all the famous ones, they already had a relationship with Charlie, so the calls would go to him, and sometimes I would find out what he said before it was in the paper, and sometimes I wouldn't. But then for more of the national media, they would come in through me, but the best thing I could do was hook them up with Charlie. That's what he wanted. He wanted to talk to them, and he was the best to do that. There were things, though, that, you know, that I would do, like write a weekly news column. His wife, when he first came to Washington, Jerry Wilson, she was very, very popular. She had a weekly news column in the papers that she had done while he was in the Texas legislature. And so she was really well known. Well, came, Charlie needed a weekly news column. My adventures learning about the Texas weeklies is a whole other issue, but it was, you know, just an amazing, amazing process, and such interesting people. And then we would do a weekly radio show where basically we'd go over to the recording studio, and I, as we walked over, I'd say, okay, this week I'm thinking we're going to do this, and I'd have a few questions written out. But he could, you know, just the way he talked, he could do things. He could say things that were memorable, sound bites. He was like a master of sound bites. And of course, the most interesting ones, when you get to the Good Time Charlie part, are the tale, and I don't remember her name, of the woman that he decided to hire to work in the front office. I don't know how he had met her, but she might have been a constituent. In any event, her husband had been a pilot killed in Vietnam. And so he was giving her a job in the office, and she created a great deal of furor in the office because she didn't really carry her weight, and she was not as qualified as she had claimed to have been to do any of the office duties. And so the tensions out in the front office got pretty high, and finally she had to be let go. And I mean, I think Charles is the one that let her go, but I'm not sure. And she immediately went to the papers, the local papers here, and said that sexual harassment, that she had been fired because she hadn't given in to Charlie's advances. And so this is the famous line where then the first call comes in, I give it to Charlie, I go sit in the room, and the reporter's telling him this is the first he's heard that she's claiming that she was sexually harassed. And Charlie said, "Are you kidding?" He said, "She couldn't get laid on a troop train." Now, so I was like, oh, okay. Well, everything pretty much dissolved after that. I mean, there was no story, and it never happened. But would that have been how I'd handled it? No. But it was extraordinarily effective. There was another time, though, that Charlie was very unfairly blamed for something that created enormous furor, and it was that for members of Congress to get a raise during their length of service, which can't happen anymore, it was changed. Somebody has to introduce a resolution to deny a raise, basically. And so, it all comes down to one person. If one person votes for it, then it all falls apart because it has to go by unanimous consent. Well, this motion comes to the floor, and Charles Wilson of California voted for it. And so everybody got a raise, and Walter Cronkite reported that it was Charles Wilson of Texas. Oh, every little old lady, you know, on a fixed income in East Texas called the office, just howling. And I, you know, so I'm running in, I'm saying, we've got to put out press releases, we've got to do this or that, you know, we've got to make sure everybody knows, you know, we're just over the top on this. And Charlie said, "Can," he said, "just settle down." He said, "This will get sorted out." He said, "And in any way, you know, I get away with so much that it's probably just in the cards for me to actually take a hit now and then."
Okay.
And I thought, oh. but then the next night Walter Cronkite corrected it, you know, which was too late for all the people who had spent long distance money on their phone calls. But you know, his attitude was just so very different. I also got another call to give you this notion, and this was when Charlie and Jerry were still married. And I got this call that said, "We just heard that Charlie Wilson got a divorce, and what can you say on that?" Well, instead of denying it, which, you know, I thought I knew well enough to deny it, but maybe I thought I didn't know well enough, I said I'd get back to him. Well, it turned out it was the other Charles Wilson again. So, but just the notion that I couldn't say definitely no, you know, probably spoke to something.
Okay. Well, can you share a little bit more? Now, obviously, the office is famous for, as you said, strategically so, for the appearance of some of the women, but also this moniker of Charlie's Angels. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, you know, I have pictures of Farrah Fawcett and Kate Jackson running around. But how did that name sort of come up? How was it embraced in the office, and how have you felt about the moniker? Speaking to y'all, it's very clear you've appropriated it as this is a wonderful bonding moniker.
Well, and as we get older, we like it more.
Fair enough.
But then that article that Kathleen wrote, I mean, you can see that the thing, again, I go back to this notion of being underestimated, and you know, if you look at any of the people, and, you know, I'll exclude myself, but Noel and Elaine and Peggy and, you know, all of these beautiful women, they could just, you know, whip anybody. They were the peer, if not the superior, of any of their opposite numbers. I mean, especially on that appropriations committee. Now, I really didn't work for him while he was on the appropriations committee, but there's no question that that is its own world, and they're the appropriations staffers, because those are people who are sort of independently funded. They're not not out of the regular budget allowance, but with the understanding that you have to have really good people in there. So these are all just superior intellects and you know, just tough as nails folks. All of his appropriation staffers, I mean, just his staff in general, I think, was not good. And it was, I wouldn't say it's a Darwinian office, but if people didn't measure up, they didn't stay. Mm-hmm. And yet, I don't remember that happening too often, that people left. When I left, Charlie, at my going-away party, made the line. He said, she's the first staff person I ever had with a parking space that voluntarily left. So, you know, it was a meritocracy. Mm-hmm. And but then in terms of the Charlie's Angels and all of that, I mean, I think from the outside, you know, people would ask us, I've been asked, did you date Charlie the Set? No. That was just not really going to happen. And I think there may have been one woman in the office he dated, but she didn't work there after that. I mean, not that they stopped, but they kept dating, but she was segued out of the office. That was not going to be an issue. The thing that Charlie always said was, you know, when you hire someone, and this goes back again to the constituents in part, but where you hire somebody from the district, you know, you make one person happy and you make a lot of people unhappy, you know, if they're as other applicants. But then the same goes with the firing. So he was not all that intent on hiring from the district like a lot of people were. But that mindset freed him up to really just try to find the best people. So, for example, Noel had been Pete DuPont's appropriations person, and he had first encountered her there, which was, again, one of the great sound bites in the world. Charlie, they were on appropriations, on foreign aid appropriations, and somebody brought up an appropriation for some, a road for some place in, I don't know, Africa or somewhere, and Pete DuPont was saying, you know, we need this money in Delaware, you know, we have roads in Delaware that have problems, we would like this money in Delaware. And Charlie says, you know, I can certainly sympathize with my friend from Delaware, I've got some counties in my district as big as his state.
Nice.
Yeah. But, you know, again, the moniker, as we get older, especially those of us, you know, now that Charlie's not that wasn't, I don't think, a moniker when I was there. Okay. I mean, it was known. Bella Abzug had an office one over from us. She mm-hmm. would come along, she would poke her head in, and she would say that phrase that was on that picture of Golda Meir in Charlie's office, and it was there. It says, you know, but can you type? I mean, she would shout out into the, you know, entry area, and then she would walk on, and, you know, I don't think we really were called Charlie's Angels. Not when I worked there.
Not when you were there. So. Mm-hmm. Well, the show came out a little late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah. About the time you left when the show came out, so I'm sure that the nickname came later.
Now, can you speak to us about, did Charlie have any aspirations beyond the office he occupied?
Oh, you know, when Senator Tower's seat came up.
Okay.
And I'm not, I don't remember the years, I don't remember many of the circumstances, but his seat was going to be vacant. People came out of the woodwork to get Charlie to run for that seat. This was relatively early on, mm-hmm. but they wanted him to run for that seat. And they said, you know, you'd make a great senator, you'd be terrific. Of course, you'd have to stop drinking, you'd have to stop partying, you'd have to stop doing this stuff. And Charlie said, no, he said, you know, if I were to run for that seat, I'd run like me. And if you're saying I can't get that seat like that, then I don't want that seat. He said, I feel like I can get a lot done here. So he affirmatively put aside those kinds of aspirations or that notion. And there were a lot of folks lined up to support him for that.
Do you have a favorite memory or memories of Charlie that you're willing to share on record? a fond memory, just no matter how marginal or it may seem. But.
Well, I do. It always sort of brings tears to my eyes. Mm-hmm. But Charlie became a great friend of my family, as you can see from that one letter. Mm-hmm. He loved my parents. My dad, as I said, was in the Navy like him, and that was very important. He always called my dad Chief. He loved my mom even up to maybe a month before he died. He called her, talked to her from time to time. She has more pictures, signed pictures of Charlie on her wall than she has of us kids. Okay, so she's got this whole wall, and it has played prominently in a few things, you know, when people come in to try to do things and they see, you know, So he was a very good friend of my family. He gave the eulogy at my dad's funeral at Arlington, which is referenced in that letter, which, as I said, I hadn't even seen until she sent it to me. But when I was still working for him, my parents came to Washington, and Charlie took us all to lunch at the members' dining room. And so when we got over there, is the dining room's all busy and all. We got this table, and my parents pulled out. They brought him a gift, and it was Carl Sandburg's 2-volume of Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. Charlie immediately opens it up, knows exactly where to go to the second inaugural address, and says, "This is my favorite thing." And he starts to read it. He starts in this, for him, you know, his voice. I mean, they always said Barbara Jordan had the voice of God. Well, you know, he's got the apostle's voice or whatever. Mm-hmm. But anyway, but he started reading it quietly. But it just, you know, the room disappeared for him, and he starts getting into it. And first I noticed that the people at the next table, I'm sort of looking, they've sort of put down and they're listening. And then it goes for, and pretty soon the whole place is quiet, and Charlie is coming, you know, with malice toward men, with charity toward all. At the end of it, literally a standing ovation. Wow. The entire, you know, dining room, they all stand up and they're applauding. Charlie is just shocked. He had no idea that anybody was even hearing him. I love that. It just, to me, it says so much about him.
Yeah. Is there anything else that, you know, we haven't asked you, or there's something you want to share and we haven't quite
Well,
asked you
as I said, I made notes. I think you probably... I probably told you more about me than about him, but...
No, you told us plenty. It's been great.
the one thing... Let's see. Well, I probably don't need to tell you how close he was to the temples, to Arthur. Called him the Eagle. That was his nickname
well,
for him.
That's all.
And Buddy. Well, he just, along with Lincoln and FDR and George Washington, he had this photograph of Arthur Temple mm-hmm. always in his office. And he just really just thought the world of him. He had given him his first real job and, right out of the Navy, and just always supported him. And then, of course, Buddy, he and Buddy were just like brothers, mm-hmm. literally till the end. But, you know, I might just say that after he left Congress, when he decided to leave, every law firm and lobbying firm in town went after him. They wanted him with him because they knew how effective he was. And this was before the book, before the movie, all of that. But and so he turned for advice really to my husband, who has been in several lobbying firms, started several. We had started ours, but who was very good at sort of negotiating, very good at negotiating, and really understood, because these law firms here have very arcane ways of figuring out, you know, if you bring in this client, how much of it do you get to keep, or how are we going to pay you? And everyone is different. Everyone has their ways of doing it. And to somebody who's never been in that world, it's impossible to really figure out what your best options are. So Charlie would call Lindsay, and he and Lindsay would talk quite a bit about this or that. We never approached him. We had this tiny little lobbying firm. There were like four of us. Mm-hmm. We thought, you know, he's going to make a lot more money someplace else. We want to help him do that. That's our, you know, fondest hope. But one day he called me and he said, Candy, he said, you know, would you all think about letting me come in? You wouldn't have to change your name or anything like that. He says, it's just, I don't understand this stuff. He said, and you're family, so I know you won't fuck me.
Sounds like his colorful language.
And so I went in to Lindsay and our friend Daryl. We were called H2O, Hooper, Hooper, and Owen. So Lindsay and Daryl Owen. And, of course, all they could think of were all the beautiful women that would come trailing in with him. They didn't care about the, you know, the business side of it. They knew he'd be fine. But, yeah, it was done. That was done. And there is one other story that I'd love to tell you, and that is that when Lindsay and I got married, which, as I said, Charlie was sort of despairing of me ever marrying.
And what year was this? I'm sorry.
So this was 1984.
Okay.
Let's see, is that right? No. Yeah, 1984. Coming up on, yeah. And we didn't tell anybody where we were going for our honeymoon, except my secretary, because my family was going to be in town still, and we wanted somebody who could deal with, you know, get in touch with us if my parents didn't make it out of town, right, or all this. So anyway, she was sworn to absolute secrecy. And so we go, so Lindsay and I take off, we got married here, and we drove over to the Eastern Shore to this little inn called the Robert Morris Inn, and we drive up, and we say, you know, we're the Hoopers, and the two elderly women behind the counter get this big smile, and they say, well, you know, maybe, did we mention that we had just gotten married when we were making the reservation? Anyway, we go up to the room, 12 dozen yellow roses on the floor, every place. In this room, I mean, you couldn't even walk. You were just knocked over by something. So he had weaseled it out of my secretary, and they were all from Charlie. So then when he married Barbara, we did the same thing to him. We got it back. But you know, it was just the sweetest thing. Mm-hmm. It was really sweet.
Well, thank you so much.
This
has been a very,
very, very
informative interview. Thank you very much.
Well, I think, yeah, I'd like to get...